All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Module 3 in the Creative Freedom Apprenticeship. This is Lisa Robin Young, who apparently can't even speak properly today. She is tripping over her own words. And today we are introducing smart, authentic selling as a part of our deeper conversation around heart-centered marketing. We've got three big pieces to cover today. And I think we're going to have time for Q&A at the end. You may have some questions that come up. Please, please, please make sure you're asking questions, whether that's via email or on these calls. That's exactly what we're here for, and I want to make sure that you're getting the help that you need. Also want to send you a little reminder that if you haven't already scheduled your benchmarking coaching session, you want to do that because we are now scheduling those second coaching sessions, and we start those next week. So I want you guys to make sure you're getting full advantage of everything that we're offering in this program. So the three pieces we're going to cover today, we're going to do an introduction to the sales cycle, which is where you find more of your right clients without the sleaze factor. We're also going to talk about love marks, which is how you go from commodity to treasured gem with your best clients. This is the best and the nicest way to eliminate competition in your market. And then we're going to talk about your red velvet rope policy, which is how you're going to cull the wheat from the chaff and make sure that the people you're working with are awesome sauce. These are people you want to work with, that you get excited about, instead of going, oh, my God, I got to deal with that person again. Oh, why did I say yes? Oh, all of that goes by the wayside when you start getting clarity on your pricing, your position in the market. All of this stuff that we're going to cover today is going to help you attract more of your right clients and customers with less hassle. So let's dig in with a conversation about coffee. I got coffee and donuts on the brain, I guess. Donuts last time, coffee this time. Coffee in and of itself is a commodity, like toilet paper. You can get it anywhere, socks, table salt. We've talked about commodities before and the idea that we need to transform our product, our offering, our great work from a commodity that isn't really valued into something that our right people see as, wow, best value, so amazing, can't believe it, a treasured gem in your market. So how do you take a 30-cent cup of flavored water and get people excited about paying $5 for it? It's not about the product. It's not about the flavored water. It's not about the temperature of the flavored water. It's not about the color of the flavored water. It's not even about the flavor of the flavored water. It's about the total experience that's wrapped around having a cup of flavored water. And this is one of the big problems with the whole idea of charge what you're worth, that mantra that you hear being bandied about quite a bit right now. Charge what you're worth and get it and that kind of a thing. That's a real sexy thing to talk about, but it's not practical because no one can really charge what they're worth. You can't charge what you're worth. You can charge what you think you're worth or what you think the market will bear for your worth, but even that is erroneous because bluntly, you're priceless. Let that marinate for a second. You're priceless. No one could ever afford to pay what you are worth. And the whole idea of charge what you're worth is a fear tactic, a scare tactic that really limits you and holds you back because the idea, while it's an admirable one, you know, it's based on the premise that most people aren't charging enough for their services, and I believe that, especially with creatives. I see people giving away, being way too generous in so many ways that are inappropriate for them to be able to run a profitable, sustainable business. So the idea of charging what you're worth, again, sexy, completely impractical, because if you were really focused on what you're worth, you're priceless. Your time and energy and resources are priceless. You cannot get them back once you've invested them. And it would be pretty impractical to charge all the money in the world for every little thing that you did because you're priceless. So if you're priceless, we've got to get past the anxiety that gets created over charging what you're worth, because that's ridiculous. Instead, we need to charge what's meaningful to you and to your client. So instead of worrying about charging what you're worth, worry about charging, don't even worry, charge what's meaningful. Charge what's meaningful. So when it comes to coffee, nobody's going to pay $5 for a cup of Maxwell House. Why? Because they know the experience of Maxwell House. They're not going to pay $5 for a cup of the store brand. Why? Because they know the experience of the store brand. Even if Maxwell House is good to the last drop, people have an expectation around what Maxwell House coffee is like, around what that experience represents for them. So they're not going to pay $5 for it. Starbucks has created a different expectation. And I use Starbucks as an example for all of the high-end coffee chains. You can insert your favorite coffee brand here, okay? But they've created an experience around their coffee that includes stylized lighting, plenty of Wi-Fi, high-end decor inside, you know, they call their coffee brewers baristas, which is a fancy term for somebody who's going to pour you some coffee, okay? The quality music, the great customer service. They try to make sure that everybody's giving you eye contact when you come into the store. If you're a gold card member, they use your name. I mean, these are the things that they've done to create this experience. And then you remember all of that when you step into the local grocery store to choose the coffee that you personally are going to brew for your morning cup of coffee during the week. You remember all of that, and you have this expectation of, ooh, well, if Starbucks is on the shelf next to Maxwell House and the store brand, I love being at Starbucks so much, I'm going to buy Starbucks. Do you pick up the tub of Maxwell House for $5, or do you pay $10 for half as much Starbucks? Most people who like Starbucks already, who have an affinity for Starbucks, will pay more for less coffee. And my husband, Lord love him, loved the cheap, like store brandish coffee that you could find until I started buying Starbucks. Now, the first couple times we bought the bold brew and it was too strong and he was not happy with that. But when we got the lightest roast of Starbucks, he was happy with it. But here's the thing, okay? The differences are slight. The flavor might be a little bit better. The quality differences in terms of how it tastes on the palate are minor compared to the store brand. And there are people who love Starbucks who would be, like, barking at me right now, okay? But the flavor differences are slight, but the experience is different. And if you think I'm, you know, talking smack here, when we're on the road, we just came back from a road trip to Tennessee. When we're on the road and we need to stop for coffee, there are only two places that we stop for coffee, McDonald's or Starbucks. We stop at gas stations all the time, but we never buy coffee there. I mean, it's like 79 cents. It's the cheapest coffee we could possibly get. You can pour it and put all the creams and sugars and anything you want to in it your way, but we don't buy coffee at the gas station. We stop at McDonald's or we stop at Starbucks. We'll make an extra stop so that we don't buy coffee at the gas station. So that's the perception. That's the expectation that we've created around coffee that my husband didn't have before I introduced him to this different level of quality. And again, the flavor difference is very minute between the store brand, cheapy stuff that he's always liked, and Starbucks. But now he doesn't buy the cheapy stuff. When he goes to the store, he buys Starbucks. Because he's had his perception shifted around the experience of drinking that coffee. And remember, I've told you before, we train people how to treat us based on what we've come to accept from them and what they've come to expect from us. So if we're expecting that the Starbucks experience is going to be better, we're willing to pay more for that instead of going to the gas station. And the day that the Starbucks coffee doesn't taste right, we're in an uproar. Like, what is this? This coffee is wrong. This can't be Starbucks coffee. You might remember the Pepsi challenge from the 80s if you're old like me, and you can remember that. They did these blind taste tests, and they put Coke and Pepsi side by side and put blindfolds on people and made them take a drink and tell them which one they liked the best. And, you know, if you're watching the Pepsi challenge commercials, Pepsi won. If you're watching the Coke commercials, Coca-Cola won. But regardless, apparently the flavor differences are minute enough that the people who have an experience with the brand are going to lean more heavily towards the brand that they prefer simply because of the experience in the past history. It's a Jedi mind trick, and that's completely what it is. That's completely what it is. Yes, there can be quality differences, but on the whole, coffee is coffee is coffee is coffee is coffee. But Starbucks, because of the way they've created an experience around their coffee, can charge substantially more for what is otherwise a commodity. So, your clients are creating expectations around the quality, the cost, the service, around everything that relates back to who you are and what you offer. So the question that we're asking in today's lesson is this one. Are you okay with those expectations? Do you want to be the Starbucks or the Maxwell House or the store brand of your market? It's a lot easier to make a profitable, sustainable living if you're seen as a Starbucks, but it comes with a different set of requirements, a different set of demands, a different set of expectations. And remember, the grocery store brand makes a profit too. That house brand of coffee is profitable or they would not be selling it. So you can be profitable and sustainable in any of those arenas, but you need to be clear on where you want to position yourself, where you want to see yourself. Now, before you can get clear on where you want to be, you need to have a reality check on where you are now. So in the homework, all of which has been posted, so you should be able to get to that right away, you'll find a business spectra worksheet. And what I want you to do is pick one of your offerings. If you're multifaceted or do a lot of different things, I want you to just pick one. Don't try and do this with all seven different things that you do because that will drive you crazy. Just pick one, do the exercise, get some clarity, and then if you want to do it again, okay? Pick one of your offerings, and this is a tool to help you get clear on the landscape of your market. So if you make jewelry, it's the fashion market. If you're a musician, it's the music market. If you're a dancer or a designer, etc., just identify the bigger market that your great work is in. All right? And me, I'm a business coach, so I have offerings in the business coaching market, and as a musician, I have offerings in the music market, okay? So then within the market that you've selected, I want you to identify three companies, not your own, three other companies, one at the high end, what you consider the high end, one at the low end, and one that's middle of the road, okay? And once you've identified them, I want you to spend some time thinking about why it is that you feel they are high-end, low-end, or middle of the road. What is it other than the price? Because price is the obvious factor, but there are all these other subtle things that go into influencing why that price makes sense, okay? And we want you to get into what is it other than the price that makes you see Starbucks as a high-end coffee? What is it that puts Maxwell House in the middle, and what is it that puts the store brand at the bottom? You know, so basically I'm asking you to explore what are the expectations. What are the expectations, these unwritten rules and ideas and constructs that, well, if you're going to charge $5 for a cup of coffee, you got to have fancy lighting, or whatever it is that you personally are seeing when you identify this business as high-end or this business as low-end or this business as middle of the road. And you can do this with any industry. If you're feeling uncomfortable about doing it with your own industry, do it with another industry first and then do it with yours. You know, what is it other than price that makes you see Walmart as a low-end retail store? Maybe it's the quality of the lighting or the wiry shopping carts. Maybe it's the level of employee training or what the employees wear or how they're groomed or how they address you at the door. There are any number of factors that can contribute to your perception of a business, and that's what's important here. We want your perception. I know some people that think Walmart is way better than Target, and I know people who think they've never set foot in a Walmart and they only shop at Target. Okay, so it's your perception that's important here. And once you've identified that high end, that low end, and then that mid-level, once you've identified those players in your market and why you think of them that way, you've got to do all that work first. Then you're ready to figure out where you fall in that mix. So I want you to pick a high, low, and middle of the road market competitor, if you will. You may or may not see them as competitors. Doesn't matter. They just have to be in your market. They have to serve the same market space, okay? You need to set your business aside so that you can understand what your perceptions are, because it's really easy to get blinded when you're playing with your own stuff, all right? So we want to understand what our perceptions are and then apply those perceptions to our business. It is really easy to get blinded to the truth of your business. So, for example, as a coach, I want to be seen as an impeccable service provider. I see impeccability as top shelf, high-end, all the way to the nines. You know, if you're impeccable, it's flawless. There's no detail that's, you know, been missed. Everything is taken care of. So if I'm thinking of myself that way, well, then, yeah, of course I'm high-end. Oh, absolutely. But when I put myself on the spectrum of other business coaches that I know that teach similar concepts that I do, and I look at them and their levels of impeccability, then I recognize that in the area of impeccability, I'm not high-end. I'm middle to high, middle of the road. I'm not impeccable all the time in everything that I do, which is actually part of my brand. Part of my brand is about being willing to embrace my imperfection. I have to embrace my quirks. That's what my audience likes about me, is that I'm unique, I'm no holds barred, I tell it like it is, and sometimes telling it like it is isn't pretty. It's not perfect. It's awkward. Sometimes it's difficult and painful. But it's real and it's authentic, and that's my brand. So positioning myself as impeccable all the time actually detracts from my brand, because my audience relates to how I'm able to succeed despite my flaws, despite the problems that are going on in my life. So instead of striving for impeccability in everything, which would be, you know, $10 million masterminds and island Fiji trips and, you know, all of this really top tier stuff, I've made a conscious choice to be impeccable in what I call the meaningful things, like worksheets that you can edit. Nothing burns my toast more than having to print off documents that I just downloaded from the internet in order to use them. Why can't I check a box or type right into the form on a document? Why do I have to print it off and write it by hand? What if I'm not near a printer? Well, now I can't use the stupid, frustration. I hate that. If I'm paying $2,000 for a class, I want to be able to use my content right now, not have to go looking for some other device to help me make it work. The technology to make these forms editable is really inexpensive, and the time investment is so worth it in terms of actually getting my clients to do the work. And that's what I want. I want my clients to get results. That's important to me. That's what impeccability is for me. So I strive to make it as easy as possible for them to do that. And that's where I strive to be impeccable. But I could easily fool myself into saying, oh, I'm not impeccable. I'm a slob. I'm totally low end because I'm not impeccable all the time. Like, you know, some other business coach who like does everything at the top tier and charges super high prices to match that. Okay? So I could totally blind myself and discount the things that I do that are impeccable. If I'm looking at myself in the moment and I'm in my own head and I'm looking at my own business and I'm not looking at myself as part of the bigger picture of my market. In the bigger picture of my market, I'm impeccable in some ways and more human and, you know, flawed in others, which puts me in the middle to high end of my market. So I'm not the highest price provider. And charging prices in that way would not work for who I am and what I offer to my right people. So at this stage in the game, for me to offer a $10 million or a $10,000 mastermind program would be ridiculous because it's not in alignment with or meaningful to me and my right clients in terms of what I offer and how I offer it. A middle to high-end provider doesn't charge those kinds of prices. That's not the expectation in the marketplace. Would it be nice to charge $10,000? Well, yeah. But there's a set of expectations that comes along with what you're going to get for $10,000 that I'm not ready to pony up to yet. Maybe someday, but not today. And I've come to accept that it doesn't make sense for me to try and offer something like that when that's not what's right for me or my audience. Let me share another really out there example. With digital downloads coming in at around $1, you can get them for 69 cents, $1.29. iTunes has music galore at various price points, but they're all around $1. I don't know a lot of people who would pay $5 million for one record with 31 songs on it. In fact, I don't know anybody personally who would pay $5 million for one record with 31 songs on it. Even if those songs came on an actual record, like a disc, in a handcrafted silver box made by a world-famous artist, I don't know anybody who would pay $5 million for it. But Wu-Tang Clan, they're a musical group. They're not my preference, but somebody likes them. They created an album with 31 songs on it and said, we're going to make one copy, only one, because we want people to remember that this is art, and art has value. And they had a vision and a mission and a set of non-negotiables about how they wanted this music to be perceived in the marketplace. So they created an experience around the auction for this disc. And I'll, there's more details posted in the download area if you're interested in, you know, getting the whole story. But they basically, you know, had people come in and they did a sampling and they did this whole experience around giving people the chance to sample some of the music so that they could try it before they bought it at $5 million. And somebody actually gave them an offer for $5 million so that they would own the only copy of this album that will ever be in existence. And it's theirs and theirs alone for the next 88 years, and then the copyright runs out. And then it's public domain. By then, we'll all be dead, probably. But Wu-Tang Clan got $5 million for this one record. Like A Piece by Van Gogh, Wu-Tang Clan is doing their part to change this landscape of music as art. So they weren't selling music. They were selling the experience of having a piece of one-of-a-kind art, which makes the whole idea of buying 31 songs much more in keeping with, okay, maybe it is worth $5 million, especially if it comes in a pretty silver box that's been handcrafted. And, you know, now there's an experience and an expectation of quality that isn't there when you go to iTunes and just download a track. Completely different. They went high-end in a big, 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 big way. And they set a minimum bid for the album, only one copy, you know, and you can totally do this for yourself if you're willing to be honest about where you and your great work fall on the spectrum of your market. And here's the thing. Right now, I see my coaching business in the mid to high end. And if that's where I want to be, great. But maybe I want to shift higher, or maybe I want to shift lower. And there's nothing wrong with either, because remember, it's just a choice. Maxwell House is profitable. The store brand is profitable. Starbucks is profitable. If I choose to be on the higher end, then I need to make shifts to reflect the higher-end values that my perceptions set up with the business I selected. So if I see myself as Maxwell House and I want to be Starbucks, I need to look at what Starbucks has that I don't that makes it more high-end. Again, this is all based on my perceptions because I've already done the work, right? And that's why we don't use your business in the analysis until after you've benchmarked with other businesses. Because if you put your business in the mix, it gets cloudy and muddy and difficult to gauge. So we look at three businesses that aren't connected to you. Why do you think they're high end? Why do you think they're low end? Why do you think they're in the middle? Now, based on those reasons, look at your own business and where does your business fall? So that's the first step. You've got to get a sense of where the market is right now and where you are right now in relation to that market. Then I want you to understand where you are in the grand scheme of business. And that's where we talk about love marks. Love marks are a concept that was developed by Kevin Roberts. And it boils down branding and loyalty by looking at what he calls the love and respect axis. And there's an image of it inside your download area. But just to give you an idea, if you create a four-quadrant grid with an X and a Y axis, you'll see love on the horizontal and respect on the vertical axis. So in looking at these two axes and you're looking at these four quadrants, in the upper right-hand quadrant, those are brands. Brands have high respect in the marketplace, but low love. People aren't like gushing over them. They're like, oh yeah, I know who they are. They're all right. They get the job done. If you move over to the right, in the top right quadrant, you're dealing with love marks. These have high love and high respect. People respect what they do and what they're about in the world, and people love them, gush over them. Apple is a great example. People can't get enough. Bring me more. They stand in line and wait for days for the launch of the new whatever gadget gizmos coming out, and they can't stop talking about it, and they can't stop writing articles about it, and they sing songs about it. That's a love mark. It's moved beyond the concept of brand into this iconic representation of something that people stand for. Okay, an idea, a movement that people stand for. Now let's come down to the lower right quadrant. High love, people still love it, but there's no respect. Okay, these are fads, like Pet Rock. People love the Pet Rock, but when its time passed, it was over. You know, parachute pants, hammer pants, back in the 80s, hammer pants, they were a fad. People loved those things. You look at them now and you're like, what was I thinking? High love, low respect. Now moving over to the lower left, low love, low respect, okay? These are your commodities. These are just products. These are just your off-the-shelf whatever. And it might be it's a product because you haven't had the opportunity yet to move it into brand status or love mark status, because this is where everything starts. Everything starts as a product, a service, an idea, a concept, as something that's going out into the marketplace. And there's a series of emotional reactions and events that have to happen that push this product into one of the other quadrants. So we've talked, you hear it talked about in business all the time, the know, like, and trust factor. If people are aware of you and they know you, okay, you're a product, you're out there. If people really like you, okay, you might be a fad. If people trust you but they don't really like you, well, you're a brand. You know, to me, Apple is a brand. To me, Apple, I don't have this undying love for Apple. There are a lot of things that I'm not particularly pleased with about the way the products are presented in the marketplace. So to me, Apple is a brand. But to some of my friends who are diehard Apple fans, it's a love mark. And that's the other thing I want you to understand is that this is all based on perception. This is all based on perception. And your best clients are going to be the ones who see your business as a love mark, who evangelize, oh, my God, she's so awesome. He's so amazing. You should really work with them. And I can't stop saying good things about how awesome this person is. When you've got those kinds of clients knocking on your door or beating down your door or driving traffic to your door, you've got a love mark in your industry, in your arena, in your sphere of influence with your right clients. So think about that and how that relates for you. There's actually a homework page for you that I developed called the, let me get there. I think it's the Love Mark Assessment. Yes, it's the Love Mark Assessment. And the questions on this assessment aren't meant to scare you, upset you, or frustrate you. They are meant to give you an awareness. And these are actually questions that are pulled from the bigger Love Mark Profiler that is on the LoveMark website. And links to that are in the resources section as well. But this assessment has been reworded so that you can answer the questions about your business instead of trying to answer the questions about another company. The way it's worded on the profiler page is it's really geared towards thinking about another company instead of your own. And so I've reworked it so that you can look at these are the elements, the bulk of the elements that need to be in place with your right people in order for you to go from commodity to treasure gem. And again, it's not about judgment. It's not about, oh, crap, I'm just a commodity. It's about awareness. Okay, right now, today, I'm a commodity. What of these things on this assessment can I start working with and improving and changing so that I'm not a commodity anymore? This is a great starting point for you to say, okay, this is what I can shift. This is what needs to stay the same. This is what has to happen differently. And then you get to be in control of how your business is going to evolve. Instead of throwing spaghetti on the wall to see what's going to stick, you can say, wow, I don't really have deep connections with my clients. They don't really know my backstory. Maybe I should start sharing pieces of that so that they understand the context of where I've come from and where I'm going. There was a time when I didn't share anything about my backstory. I always talked about this is where we're going, this is what we're going to do, charge forward, move forward, move forward. And people who were coming into my audience didn't get it because they didn't understand where I'd been. So I started incorporating stories about my past, stories about my family, stories about where I had been so that they could see where I am and understand where I'm going. And people started getting on board going, ah, it's like I've known you forever. It's like you can read my mind. I'm like, really? And they're like, oh, I can so totally relate to you. I had the same thing happen. Those are things that are important to me. That's how I connect to my audience. You have to get clear on what it is that connects your audience with you so that you can go from commodity to charging what's meaningful for you. You know, if you're a graphic designer and you're charging $50 an hour, that's a hard life. But if you can find yourself positioned in a way that you feel comfortable charging $100 or $200 or $400 an hour because that's meaningful, not because you're just slapping a high price tag on something. If you can do that, then your clients value you more and you value you more and you value your clients more because, well, hey, they're paying you more if for no other reason. But let's be clear, this isn't a conversation about price by itself. Price never stands alone. If price was the only factor for most people, everyone would shop at Walmart. Everyone would shop at the lowest price provider. So it's not just about the price. It's also about the experience. And when you're looking at those perceptions, you want to get clear on what's the experience you're creating, what's the experience you're willing to create in order to either move higher or lower on the spectra of your business market. Because once you understand that stuff, it's so much easier to find customers. Inside your download area, you're going to find a picture of something called the sales map, or the sales cycle, I'm sorry, the sales cycle. And this is a map I created about 4 or 5 years ago that gives you an at-a-glance look at where customers are found. And I don't mean, oh, you found them at the grocery store or you found them, you know, online. I'm talking about where in the cycle of selling are you bumping into people. Sometimes it really is, I met them at a speaking event or I met them at the grocery store or I was in line at the pet shop and, you know, was talking to this person and bam, there they were. Or I was in a class with them or whatever. That's the initial meeting, when you meet someone for the first time or they meet you or meet your business for the first time, that's at the top of this circle that goes around. There's six different points where someone can do business with you. Sometimes they will buy from you the minute they meet you. Girl Scout standing on your front porch saying, hi, it's Girl Scout cookie time. Would you like to buy a box of Girl Scout cookies? Yummy and delicious. They're only $4. And you shell out your $4 never having met this person before. That's when you're meeting someone for the first time and you're doing business with them. Does it happen often? No. We usually have to be exposed to either the person or the brand, i.e. you've been exposed to Girl Scout cookies before. So you understand the experience of a Girl Scout cookie and you're willing to pay money to help the kid out and get yourself some Girl Scout cookies right there on the spot. Now, they might come to you as a lead, i.e. they opted into your website like so many people do for me. They sign up on my newsletter list. They get a 7-day e-course that talks about what it means to have creative freedom. And they come to me as a lead, and somewhere in that process, they decide they want to do business with me. Okay, great. Let's make magic happen. And once they've done business with you, regardless of where they come to you at, they are now your client. All of you in this class are my clients. We've been working together now, and we've had this experience. And so that's what you are now to me, is a client. And you may choose, while you're working with me in this program, to buy something else from me. I know there's at least one other person in this class who's currently going through another program that I have available. So it does happen. Your current clients become deeper invested in you because you're investing more with them of your time, your energy, your attention, your services, your skills, your expertise, all that awesomeness that's carried around in the package that is you. They get a taste of it and then they want more. And that's ideal because it's much less costly for a business to keep their existing clients than it is to go find new ones. So you've got a client. Then you've got to deliver on the promise of whatever it is that they've purchased from you. And this is where you can do more business. Hey, you're in this program and you've decided you want to take it deeper. I can offer you, you know, an extra 3 coaching sessions for this special price. And you say yes, and bam, you've done business with me again at the delivery phase. And once all of that's done and this course is ended, maybe I decide, hey, you know what, I want to give you something extra special. I'm going to put together a little book for you, or I'm going to send you a little something-something in the mail or whatever, and you get that bonus and you go, hey, I've been meaning to buy XYZ from you, so I want to buy something from you. And boom, we're doing business again. And then there's this other interesting thing, this interesting section of what I call the sales cycle, which is reciprocity. And this is where you're doing something that has absolutely nothing to do with your business. Maybe you're donating to charity. Maybe you're volunteering. You're giving your blessings to bless others. That's this reciprocity space, okay? And it might sound strange to include this as part of the sales cycle since it really is kind of intangible and it's most people don't think of it as part of sales. And you certainly don't want to be doing reciprocity in order to get sales. Okay, that's the hard end of giving to get, and that's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is this experience that I've had and my clients have had is that some of the best business that they get, and positive public exposure, by the way, comes from giving back to the community, you know. And a lot of times it's better to give your time than your money anyways. You show up and you're there to participate and help for a cause that you believe in, for something that's meaningful to you, and you meet other people who become your clients. And sometimes they're becoming your client because you were involved in that thing and it was meaningful to them, and so it's meaningful to have you working with them. Your business can be a vehicle for some really cool things, and you're not even out trying to drum up business. You're out trying to make a difference and make an impact and do something that's meaningful to you, and boom, you're making business happen because of this idea called reciprocity, which puts you back into the space of meeting new people. And so it's this cycle, this circle that goes around and around and around. And I'll go through those one more time. The first step on this circle, this cycle, is when you meet people. You're meeting them for the first time. The second place is where they become a lead for you. The third place is where they're actually a client. They do business with you because they've done business with you before. The fourth place is where you're delivering on whatever it is that they've invested with you for. or you're giving them a bonus, that's number five, as a thank you or a, hey, you're special or happy birthday or, well, just because. And then that sixth spot is where you're reciprocating and you're giving back to your community, maybe even to your audience, but you're doing something that's selfless, not because you want to get sales, but getting sales becomes a byproduct of all this awesomeness that you're spreading around in the universe. So those are those six steps on the sales cycle. And you can find people anywhere along. They come to you from all over that spot, all over that circle. They're there waiting for you. But you can't connect with them if you don't understand how you fit into the spectra. Because let's be clear. If you are a store brand coffee in your marketplace and you want to offer your services, you're not likely to want to go volunteer at the local art museum and rub elbows with all your community leaders, because chances are good you're going to feel like they're looking down their nose at you because you serve the house brand coffee market when they are Starbucks connoisseurs. So it wouldn't make sense for you to be in those circles. On the other hand, if you love art and it lights you up like a Christmas tree and you want to go volunteer as a docent at the local gallery so that you can talk about art in all these meaningful ways, then chances are good you're going to bump elbows with somebody who needs what you have to offer, and bam, you're doing business not because you intended to, but because it was a byproduct of you being awesome and creating some reciprocity in your world and in your business. And it's in alignment with who your right people are and how you like to show up in the world. So that's how that works. That's the sales cycle. And you've got an image of that map so that you can look more closely at that. Once you have clarity on where you want to show up and how you like to show up and where you fall on the spectra, then you can start doing things like creating your red velvet rope policy. And that's this last piece that we're going to talk about today. Now, the red velvet rope policy is not a new concept. I got it from Michael Port and his work with the book. He wrote the book, Book Yourself Solid, Beyond Book Solid. He's got a whole franchise of Book Solid type stuff. But this concept is really key. Imagine that you are at a red carpet event, the Grammys, the Oscars, the Tony Awards, whatever, and there's all these high-profile people. And they have this red velvet rope that you can't get past because you're not one of those people. You're standing on the wrong side of the velvet rope, and you can't get past security because you're not one of those high-profile red carpet people. And Michael makes the statement, which I think is valid, that you need to create that kind of an experience for your right clients. You need to dig into, if I'm going to put up a red velvet rope and only let certain people walk down my red carpet to my business door, who are those people? Now, if you're high-end, maybe you really do have a red carpet and a velvet rope, and, I mean, it physically exists leading up to your office space. I know an advertising firm in my hometown, and that's exactly what they have. They have a red carpet. They have the little stanchions with the velvet robes that line the walkway as you're walking up to their door. And it deters some people from going in because they don't feel like they're dressed well enough. They're underqualified to be walking through the doors of that establishment. And he's told me it weeds people out just because it's there. And that's what a good red velvet rope policy does for your business. And so you have this document that's going to help you work through a preliminary draft of your red velvet rope policy. And these are questions that you need to get clear on. Instead of taking just anybody off the street who's got a pulse, who can fog up a mirror, who are the people that you really resonate with? Who are the people that you really want to work with? Who are the people that make your heart leap out of your chest in joy and delight to work with them? And how do you get more of those people into your business? And your red velvet rope policy forces you to create what I call your ABC list. And using that red velvet rope idea, your A-listers, your A-list clients, these are people you can't get enough of, you want more of. If you could clone them, you would be the happiest person on the planet. Your C-list clients are the people that you really need to cut. You need to fire them. You need to get rid of them, but maybe you're not ready to do that yet, okay? But it's clear that this ain't working. And then your B-list clients are those middle-of-the-road people that you're not really sure about one way or the other. Maybe they've got some good things going for them, and then they're a pain in the butt in other ways. And, you know, you're on the fence about whether they're A-list or C-list. So this worksheet that you have, this red velvet rope policy worksheet that you have, helps you define what kind of clients you don't want. You know, who are those C-list people you're already working with? And then you flip it around. You look at, well, what do you really want? What's really going to fill you up and light you up and give you a sense of peace and ease and joy in the work that you're doing? And who are you already working with that's doing that? So you're making a list of these things. And then you're going to identify the threads, the positive qualities that these people have in common, and you're going to identify some more non-negotiables in terms of the people that you want to work with. What kind of qualities do they have to have? What are you absolutely not going to put up with anymore? Now, I will be the first one to tell you, this is scary and hard. Not hard in the doing, hard in the enforcing and implementing. Because once you make this list, you can't unsee it. Once you recognize that three of the clients who pay you the most money are three clients you need to fire, things get kind of tense. They choke you up, and you're like, oh, well, you know, I kind of need that money. But I will share the story that I've shared many times in various classes and calls. I had a client who needed a good portion of her mortgage before the end of the week, or she was going to have serious problems at home. And she had the opportunity to work with what she called the pain in the butt client, who came to her and said, this is what I want you to do, this is what I'm going to pay you, da-da-da-da-da, will you take it? And she already knew this was a C-list client, that anytime she worked with this person, it meant lots of extra hand-holding, lots of extra tedium and phone calls and back and forth. And, you know, it cost her a lot in time, in terms of energy invested into this client for what they were willing to pay. But she needed the money. She needed this money. And so she said, you know, give me a chance to get back with you on this. I need a day to check my schedule and see what I can do. Now, her calendar was completely clear, okay? But she used that so that she had some time to really sit with, what do I want to do? And she made the decision to say no thank you, which was really hard because that cash was right in her face and she knew it would have covered everything. And she said, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that right now. And before the week was up, she had another person come to her and say, I have this job that I need done. I've been told that you're really good. I want to work with you. What are your rates? She told them the rates, and she got paid, you know, no hassle, no fuss, no muss. And she started working with this client, and it turned out to be a great client, and they've been working together for years now, as far as I know. And she said to me, Lisa, had I said yes to the pain in the butt client, I would have been so busy working for them that I wouldn't have had the bandwidth to be able to say yes to my right client, who I love, who loves me, and it's just an awesome relationship. But because she held out for the better client and they showed up, not only did she get the money to do the work that she loves with the person that she loves doing it with, she also got space, because she didn't have all of that extra energy and time invested in hand-holding this client because the client trusted her to do the work. So you need to be thinking about the total profitability of what it is you're doing. Yes, dollars are important, but so is your sanity. So is your self-respect. So is your time with your family or doing whatever it is that means something to you, if it's not family time. And that's what this Creative Freedom Program is about, is getting clear on what are your non-negotiables, who are the kind of people you really want to work with, and finding ways on that sales cycle spectrum, or sales cycle and then the spectrum, to see how you fit in the marketplace. How can you use your differences and your uniquenesses in a way that allows you to capitalize on what you do best for the people who love you best? That's what this is about. So when you're looking at this and you're creating that initial draft of the Red Velvet Rope policy, you know, it says, in order for me to do my best work and to honor my best clients, this is my client policy. My best work is done with people who have these personal characteristics, you know, whatever those top five qualities are. I do my best work when I, and this comes back to your non-negotiables. Therefore, based on all of that information, I will not accept clients who behave in this way, have these characteristics, refuse to participate in this way, and I will not work under these conditions. So you're looking at both the positives and the negatives of your business, and you're very clear. This becomes your guiding principle around how you're going to show up and do work in the world. And it makes it really clear for people who are coming to you about whether or not they even want to have the conversation about working with you in the first place. So I know we're coming up on time here. I want to give you guys an opportunity to ask questions. If you have any questions, star 6 will put you in the queue so that we can hear your questions and get them answered. And while you guys are thinking about what it is you want to ask, I want to remind you that all of these homework assignments so far have not been about putting a gun to your head and making you do anything differently than what you're already doing. Everything we've talked about so far is about developing awareness. I want you to be aware of what needs to change. I want you to be aware of what's working. I want you to be aware of who you like to work with and who you don't. I want you to be aware of all of those things. So the whole first half of this program has been about becoming aware. Now, the thing that I will tell you about awareness is, like I was saying a minute ago, you can't unsee it. Once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. And so then it sits there and it taps you on the shoulder and says, okay, well, now that you know that, what are you going to do about it? Now that you know that, what are you going to do about it? Now that you know that, how are we going to fix this, change this, whatever? So as we move into the second half of this program, we're going to get more brass tacks on what are the things you're going to do in the order that you're going to do them. Because I'm sure, as the day is long and as there are creative minds in the world, that you can come up with a laundry list of things that need to change and have to be different, and that can be overwhelming. How do I know where to start? How do I know what to do next? How do I know? What am I? I've been there. And once you have these awarenesses in place and once you've drafted this Red Velvet Rope policy, then you can have a compass for, well, based on this, then the next logical thing for me to do would be this thing. And based on the available time I have or the level of complexity or the fact that I'm just one person, then I really need to focus here first. And that's what we're going to spend the second half of this course digging into, is what's your roadmap going to look like? What's your specific set of next steps going to be so that you can move the ball down the field faster, more efficiently, and more appropriately for who and what you are in the marketplace? I'm going to give you guys one last chance for questions because I'm not seeing any in the queue. And, you know, this is your time. So if you've got questions, chances are good other people have them too, and I want to make sure that you have a chance to articulate them and get the help that you need. And I get that sometimes, you know, they can be private and personal and you want to handle that on a coaching call, but don't feel shy on my account. I'm here to help you guys. That's really what this is about. So if you've got a question, press *6 and we'll answer it. You got like 2 seconds here. Going once. Going twice. Okay, no questions this week. If anything comes up, you guys know how to reach me. Just email me, and we'll make sure that you get your questions answered. I'm back in the saddle now after having been gone a week, so I'm checking emails and replying as fast as I can to those. And for those of you who have coaching sessions on the calendar, great, I will be seeing you. If you haven't already scheduled your second coaching call, you can start doing that now. If you haven't scheduled your first one, you better get on it because this is the last week to make that happen. Otherwise, you'll forfeit the call because you guys get two for this session. Next week, we are going to step into client research and choosing the right platforms to spread your message and reach more of your right audience. And then we'll start rolling into frameworks. And again, more of the brass tacks, get stuff done your way, the right way, approaches. And until next week, this is Lisa Revenyoung signing off, everybody, and blessings and peace. Have a great, great day. Take care.